Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and each week I meet with military veterans about their civilian career to learn what they do, how they got there, and advice for other veterans seeking to do the same. Today's episode number 197 with author Cal Newport.
Master something, and suddenly you're going to notice really compelling opportunities. Start from scratch, and it's like you're at the kiddie table. You're not really going to come up with something that the world cares about.
Well, today's episode originally aired all the way back in March of 2017, so it's been over a year since I sat down with Cal Newport about his book, So Good They Can't Ignore You. But it is hands down one of the conversations I think about most, and one of the episodes that I really wish every single member of the armed forces could listen to. The premise of this book is that follow your passion is not only bad advice, it's extremely detrimental advice because it leads you to false expectations around your career and also looking for the wrong things. Cal, in his book and in this interview, talks about instead how you can approach your career in a way that no matter what, you can find success, happiness, and enjoyment. He is a New York Times best-selling author, and his father was actually in the Navy, so it was awesome to see that from him. So I wanted to rebroadcast this episode for any of you who may have missed it. And if you like this episode, if you go to the website and find episode number 96, which will also be in the show notes, I review a book of his that I also think about more than anything at work that's called Deep Work. And he talks about how to change the way you work to be more productive. And that will be in the show notes as well. So keep the feedback coming at beyonduniform.io. Let me know what other sorts of interviews would help you. We've got more of the traditional format coming to you next week. But I hope you enjoy this rebroadcast of my conversation with Cal Newport. So joining me today in Washington, D.C. area is Cal Newport. Cal, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
I'm happy to be here.
So before I go into Cal's background, I wanted to first give listeners a quick backstory. So normally I interview veterans about their civilian career. However, Ryan Ginna, who I interviewed in episode number 61, told me about a month ago about this book called So Good They Can't Ignore You, which is one of several books that Cal has written. And I loved it. I read about 50 books last year. I would say this is in the top two, if not the best book I read last year in terms of impact on thinking about a career. It's one that I would recommend to every single veteran, whether you're currently on active duty or whether you've been out of the military for 20 years. I really think it has something that everyone could benefit from. And I want to make it clear, I in no way financially benefit from this recommendation. It's just a genuine endorsement for something that will help veterans. So we're going to talk today about So Good They Can't Ignore You and how this relates to any and all veterans. But first, some quick background on Cal. He is an associate professor of computer science at Georgetown University, where he specializes in the theory of distributed algorithms. He previously earned his PhD from MIT in 2009 and graduated from Dartmouth College in 2004. In addition to studying the theoretical foundations of our digital age as a professor, Cal also writes about the impact of these technologies on the world of work. He is the author of the recent book Deep Work, which I'm going to be reading next, and also the author of So Good They Can't Ignore You, which argues that following your passion is bad advice. Inc. magazine listed it as one of the best business books of the year, and Cal's related op-ed in the New York Times was one of their most emailed articles for the entire site. So Cal, to kick things off, maybe you could give us a little bit of the context around which you started to write this book.
The idea behind the book project was pretty simple. I wanted to understand how people ended up loving what they do for a living. And the actual context of my life that brought that up was I was going through a major career transition myself. This is when I was beginning to make the transitions from grad school into the academic world. And the thing about an academic job is if you do it right, it's basically going to be your job for life. And that was a little bit scary. So I figured if there was any time in my life that I needed an answer to the question of how do people end up loving what they do, I needed that answer then before I started making commitments that could last for decades. So that was the impetus to start researching this question. And how I did it was actually pretty straightforward. I just found a lot of people who love what they do for a living. And I talked to them. You know, tell me about your story. Mm-hmm. Tell me about your path. How did you get there? Why do you love this? How did that develop? And then over time, I began to fill in some of the gaps there with some research from the scientific literature to understand better what I was learning. But it was basically, I wanted to start from a blank slate in attacking this question that a lot of people, I think, ask.
And that's one of the things I loved about the book was the balance of these personal narratives with some easy to relate to data around the significance of that. And let's maybe talk about the kind of the central premise of this part one. I loved one of the quotes you had, which was, telling someone to follow their passion is not just an act of innocent optimism, but potentially the foundation for a career riddled with confusion and angst. And if you could expand on that a little bit for listeners of, you know, why is it in essence that it is such not just bad, but potentially damaging advice to say, just follow your passion.
Right, which was an idea that immediately pops up when you start looking into this question of career and career satisfaction. The very first thing you're going to hear, the thing that's going to pop up in the standard career books, the thing that's going to pop up in casual conversations or interviews with celebrities or CEOs, this idea, oh, you should just follow your passion. And so one of the first things I did was dive into that. Why do we think that's true? And does it work? And it became clear quite soon in my research process that this idea that you should follow your passion is dangerous advice. Now, I want to be clear about what I mean by that, because people often confuse the issue. I'm not saying the goal of ending up passionate about your work is bad. In fact, the entire purpose of this book is to figure out how can you end up passionate about what you do for a living. The particular strategy, however, of identifying a pre-existing passion and then using that passion as the foundation for which you make your career choices, the strategy that's encapsulated in that advice to follow your passion, that strategy does not have a lot of validation. And actually, for most people, it's going to go contrary to how career passion typically develops and could actually slow you down, add more confusion, or actually put up obstacles in your path to actually end up with lasting satisfaction for your work. So I would be happy if we just struck that phrase and even struck the word passion altogether when we talk about careers, because I think it's confusing the issue with ideas and strategies that we don't have a lot of foundation in fact for.
And I love that, because I know that so many of the veterans that I interview on the show, there is just such a tremendous burden when they're leaving active duty to try exactly the same process you went through, which is I'm going to be making a decision that potentially could be decades of my time. And I love your approach, because I think it takes off a lot of pressure of finding this dream spouse, finding this ideal job, finding this thing that just lights you up immediately. I think that what I like about when you're dispelling that is that it reduces the pressure of the veteran to find their 100% dream job match and makes it something more attainable.
Right. We place way too much emphasis in our modern American culture on the match when it comes to workplace satisfaction. We're used to that now. So we think, of course, it's all about finding the right job for me. But this is actually a very new concept. You know, I went back and actually studied the etymology of the phrase follow your passion. When did we start saying this? When did this enter our lexicon? And it was really not until the late 1980s, early 1990s that people began to even talk this way, that it's all about figuring out first what you want to do and then matching it to your job. And so it's not some ancient wisdom that's being handed down to us from the Plato or Aristotle. It's actually a relatively new invention in our cultural conversation. And the reason this advice doesn't work is because it requires two assumptions to be true in order for it to be effective. The first assumption it requires to be true is this idea that most people have clearly identifiable pre-existing passions. The idea that you should follow your passion depends, its very definition depends on this idea that you have a pre-existing passion that you can identify and then follow. The advice makes no sense with that assumption not being true. We don't have a lot of evidence that this is true for most people. I mean, certainly there are people who say, I know what I want to do, they do that, and they're happy. But this is much more rare than the ubiquity of this advice would leave us to believe. And in fact, we have a lot of evidence that for most people, especially people who are younger in their career or younger in their life, don't, or much more likely not to have some clear inclination towards a particular career. So we have no reason to believe that this should be the case, that you're hardwired for something. So already, if you fall into that category, this advice can't help you. The second assumption that this advice depends on for it to be effective is this notion that if you really like a given topic and then you match that topic to your work, then you'll really like your work. That's the underlying sort of syllogism at the core of this advice is, hey, I really like basketball. So if I work in the front office at an NBA team, I should love that job. Again, we have a lot of evidence that that's not true. Now, workplace satisfaction has very little to do with matching the specific content of the work to a pre-existing interest. And we have too many cliched stories of passionate amateur bakers, for example, who end up miserable once they open their own bakery. That tells us workplace satisfaction really has very little to do with matching the content of this job to some pre-existing interest. So once we get rid of those two assumptions, we realize that we have no reason to believe that this advice, figure out what you want to do, then go follow it, is going to be particularly effective. And that's why I say it's dangerous, because it doesn't work for most people, but if it's all they've heard, then that's all they know to try. And when it doesn't work out, when all you've heard is follow your passion, all work out, and it doesn't work, you can't find a passion, or you have something you're passionate about, but you match it to your job and you're not happy in the job. If all of you heard is follow your passion, this leads to confusion. It leads to chronic job hopping. It leads to despondency and unhappiness. That's why I say you could be causing more trouble than benefit if this is the only message you give to people.
And I love the example you give of Steve Jobs. If he had followed the work he loved, he would have been in a Zen monastery. You know, it wasn't necessarily technology that excited him in his personal life. And I love that you also give this example of that, you know, the more experience an assistant has, the more likely they are to enjoy their work. And just pointing out that expertise, you know, or I think you call it the three components, or the three nutrients to be motivated at work, are around autonomy, competency, and relatedness, this thought of being connected to others. And I love that thought that, like, yes, the better you get at a job, the more you're going to enjoy it. And that takes time to build that up. And that kind of leads into the next point, which I love that, you know, right off the bat, you assert following your passion is BS. It's bogus advice. But you provide a better approach, which you call the craftsman mindset. And I recently interviewed Steve Reinemann. He's the former CEO of PepsiCo. He talked about on the show what he called a hip pocket skill. And he talked about encouraging veterans to really refine a core skill around which they can build a career. So maybe before we dive into a discussion around this, how would you explain what you mean by a craftsman mindset?
Yeah, the craftsman mindset is when you approach your work asking, what value am I bringing to the world? That stands in opposition to the way that many people who were raised on the advice to follow your passion see the world of work, which is asking, what value is this job bringing to me? So if you're asking, what value is this job bringing to me? I call that the passion mindset. And it causes lots of problems, because jobs are hard. And if you're new to a job, there's probably a lot of it that's going to be annoying. And so if you're constantly asking, what value does this job bring to me? You're going to constantly find things that you don't like or negative, and it's going to lead to a lot of this indecision and chronic job hopping. The craftsman mindset's to reverse. It says, well, wait, what value am I offering? What value am I offering the world in this company? And if the answer is not very much, then you can say, now I have my challenge set out for me. I need to get better. I need to improve my craft. I want to offer more value to the world.
I love you said at one point in your book, there's something liberating about the craftsman mindset. It asks you to leave behind self-centered concerns about whether your job is just right, and instead put your head down and plug away at getting really damn good. No one owes you a great career, it argues. You need to earn it, and the process won't be easy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is the key, I think, to the whole findings of this book, is that, as you mentioned before, if you study people who love what they do, what you find is the things that lead people to love their job are not very specific to the type of work. They're things that you can get in many, many different fields. And you mentioned some of them before. A sense of autonomy leads people to love their work. A sense of mastery and skill leads people to love their work. A sense of impact on the world and a sense of connection to other people. These things lead people to love their work, much more so than I match this job to some interest I had in advance. But how do you get these things in your job? How do you get a ton of autonomy? How do you get a sense of mastery? How do you get to do stuff that has huge impact? From an economic perspective, these are all things to be earned. They're rare and valuable. People want them in their career. They're hard to get. So the right mindset is one of, what can I do to earn autonomy and impact and mastery and connectiveness and these traits that make people love to work? What can I do to earn those? What skill can I put together that gives me leverage so that I can basically negotiate for those things in my working life? That seems to be the process that leads people to the true passion in their work. But it's a long process where as you get better and as you use the skill as leverage to shape your job, passion grows over time. So it's really the reverse of what we're told, which is, no, the passion should be there in the beginning, and you either unlock it by taking the right job or you don't.
I think what resonated with me about this, and I think with a lot of veterans it will resonate, is it seems like what you're saying is, rather than expending all this energy of finding the job that you're made for, it's saying, like, whatever you're doing right now, put your head down and do the best freaking job you can possibly do. Like, get as much value, get as many skills as you can. And it's about doing the job in front of you to your best possible ability. And that good things come from that, rather than, you know, putting the cart before the horse and seeking out this autonomy, seeking out this high profile job, seeking out whatever is next. It's more about focusing on what's in front of you and really blowing that out. Am I representing that correctly?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the actual choice of the job is a lot less important than we think. What you do when you get the job is a lot more important than we've been giving credit. Now, this doesn't mean that you can just, of course, throw a dart at a job board and whatever it hits, just go do that and end up loving what you do. I think it's worth emphasizing that there's some natural disqualifiers that could prevent the job from being a source of passion for you, no matter how aggressively you build skills. So, for example, if what the organization does is contrary to your deeply held values, that's a problem. If you don't like the people, the boss is terrible, the you have a real mismatch with the coworkers, that's a problem. If you find the work that you're doing on a fundamental level is of very low value to the world, that could be an issue. So it's not that any job can be transformed to a source of passion, but I like to think of it as many, many jobs can. So you're lowering the threshold to, hey, is this something that's interesting to me and would offer me interesting rewards and options if I got really good? If your answer is yes to those two questions, and for most veterans, there will be many jobs that satisfy those two criteria, then it's as good as any other choice. Don't sweat it. Go for it and really put your head down and focus on how can I build up as much skill as possible, because that is going to be the foundation on which passion comes.
I love it. I love it. And that kind of leads into the next field I wanted to talk about, which is this concept of career capital. And I love, you had so many great snippets, but I love you say you have to get good before you can expect good work. Or even better, you said, let me see, where was that? You had talked about, I'm paraphrasing this, but if you want a job that's like really energizing and really that you can be passionate about, that's really rare and valuable. And it's just basic economic principles that if you want something rare and valuable, you have to have something rare and valuable to offer in return. And so, you know, that's kind of what I took away from this thought of career capital, which we'll talk about next, but this thought of like really building up capital, building up this rare and valuable skill set, this rare and valuable ability that will allow you to trade that for a rare and valuable career or job satisfaction. And let me pause there and make sure I'm not misrepresenting anything there. Is that on par?
Yeah, that's definitely on point. I think thinking about career satisfaction through this economic lens really opened up for me my understanding of all these stories I was hearing. It suddenly made all these stories I was hearing about real people who really love what they do make sense. And once you hear it, it makes a lot of sense, right? Is that the things that make people love their work is valuable because people want to really love their work. So it just stands to reason you have to have something to offer in return to get it. Mm-hmm. Simply because you just want a job that has a ton of autonomy and gives you a sense of impact and you feel a sense of mastery doesn't mean that anyone's going to give that to you. You gotta wrench that away from people. You gotta win that out over everyone else who wants a job like that. And your main leverage is your skills in the marketplace. What can you do that's rare and valuable? How good are you? The better you get at things that are rare and valuable, the more leverage you have, and the more leverage you have, the more of these good things you can get into your working life. No one will give them to you just because you want them.
And you have to earn them. I think that's so relevant to the veteran community, because I think this is a group of people who have been taught how to and have experienced doing the impossible. And so sometimes I think this works against the veteran community, where someone will get straight out of the military and think, I can do anything, and they'll take a leap where they might not have the capital necessary to achieve that. You know, and I think you give a lot of great examples of your book of the person who's courageous and has that hunger and desire and quits their job and starts, you know, the lady who's like an ad agency executive and starts a yoga studio, and just pointing out, like, you know, she hasn't built up the capital in yoga to make that transition, you know, a high probability of success. You know, she built up so much capital in the ad world, but that doesn't translate into what she's doing. And so I think it's an important counterbalance to the raw courage and determination that characterizes a lot of veterans that needs to have that capital to accompany it.
Right. So that's why I introduced this notion of career capital, just to make this type of thought process a little bit more concrete. So just to provide the definition, career capital is essentially a metaphorical substance I came up with that you can think of as measuring how much value you have to the marketplace. So the more rare and valuable your skills become, you can think about it like you have more career capital in your career bank account. And I like to imagine it's this capital that you invest to get really cool traits in your job, to get features in your job that make it really cool. And when you think about it this way, it really simplifies a lot of thinking about career transitions or career changes. Because now, for example, if you're unhappy about something in your career, you can think about it in these concrete terms and say, okay, well, first of all, do I have the career capital right now to change it? That is, do I have the skills for leverage? If the answer is no, then you say, well, what do I need to do to, as quickly as possible, build enough career capital that I can change these things I don't like about my job? And if you're in a situation where you say, you know what, in this particular job, no amount of career capital can be exchanged for changing this, it's just fundamental to the job, the metaphor helps you make a transition to another job in a very effective way, because you can ask, how much would this new marketplace value the capital I already have? In other words, how much do they value the skills I already have? And you want to be more likely to move to places that will value the skills you already have, but offer you more options on how to invest them. So that's why the article about the failed yoga instructor was sort of a great example of this framework not being used. She had a lot of career capital related to marketing and advertisement, but she wanted a lot more autonomy over her time and schedule and more connection to other people. So she didn't think about her capital. She just thought about the content of jobs and said, well, to be a yoga instructor, I'd have a lot more autonomy over my time and I'd have a lot more connection to people. But she had no career capital in that field. So she couldn't expect to get large levels of that until she built up a lot of capital, which she didn't have. So she threw out all the capital she had built up in the world of marketing ad agencies and instead went to a world where she had no career capital, did a quick certification. And of course, that yoga endeavor, you know, did not go well for her. She ended up, you know, on food stamps and essentially out of money pretty quickly because she had no capital to exchange for being gainfully employed with all this autonomy and mastery. So once you start thinking about what's the career capital I have, how can I get more, how can I invest it, it really gives a lot of clarity to otherwise ambiguous seeming career thinking.
I love this. And I think to directly apply this to a lot of the people I've interviewed. So here's the way I was thinking of it in a military framework. It's you are in the military and you build up a lot of career capital in whatever you're doing. That could be with sonar, that could be with what, you know, special forces. You're building up a very specialized set of career capital. Now, when you leave the military, you have basically two options. It's to go directly to a job that values that career capital, that really uses that highly developed skill set. And as example, John Fennick, who I interviewed on the show, he did satellites in the Air Force. He studied at MIT. That's all he did in the Air Force. He went out to business school, gained some more capital, started a satellite company, and sold it to Google for $500 million. But it was leveraging the capital he built up in the Air Force. So that's one option. You know, maybe government contracting, military contracting, things like that are going to more highly prize that capital. Or, like a lot of people I interview, they don't want to do the same thing they did in the military, so they're going back to almost zero on career capital. And I think of Jimmy Sopko, who I interviewed, who took a pay cut, huge pay cut, to go to Pinterest. Started at the ground entry-level position. He was 28. Everyone else was 23. He started as an account manager. He worked really hard and built up new skill sets and was able to, you know, work his way up faster than his peers. But it was taking a step back in career capital to build up skill sets that he didn't have. And I'm wondering, Cal, if that sounds about right in terms of how someone on active duty might think of the career capital they have right now.
Yeah, I think that's a very useful way of using the career capital metaphor, right? You've got this option. You can go somewhere that directly values the capital you built up, and then you can add on to it and then use it as leverage pretty soon to start shaping your career. Or if you go somewhere new, which I have to imagine is something that's going to happen often in the transition out of active service, just because some of the things you work on could be so specific that there's not really a good outlet for it in the working world. You have to have that hustle mindset, but career capital theory helps you understand why you need that mindset. You say, okay, I'm coming to something new. I'm coming to Pinterest at the ground floor. I don't want to care at all about am I enjoying my job day to day. It's got to be hustle capital, get that up as quickly as possible so I'm in a position to invest. So I think that provides a lot of clarity to these stories that you have been, you know, you're talking about here, that you've heard on the show. It gives you a sort of metaphor to help structure what's going on.
And I just love this capital framework, this career capital framework, because a lot of the interviews I've had where there's frustration, I think there's this expectation getting out of the military that a great job will just be handed to them, or a great job will just find them. And I just love this thought of viewing it as like, okay, what is the capital you've built up and how do you want to use that capital? And like you said, most people, at least I've interviewed, they end up departing pretty far from the military. And that just needs to come with a mindset of, all right, it's nose down, just working really assiduously to build up more career capital, because you're starting almost from zero at that point.
Right. I mean, sort of the worst thing you could do would be to go to a job in an unrelated field where you had very low career capital and then immediately adopt the passion mindset and start asking, wait, do I love this job? Is this what I'm meant to do? Did I like it today? Do I like the work I did today? Is this really what I want to be doing? Because that is what's going to slow you right down and prevent you from building up the capital that you need before anything good can come. Mm. Until you have that capital, you don't even know what the possibilities are. So yeah, thinking about it, what's my capital store? And how can I increase it is key. Though I want to add the other caveat I point out in the book is the hard thing about career capital is you've got these pitfalls that if you try to, you know, get a bunch of autonomy in your life before you have capital, that's a problem. So you quit your job to be the yoga instructor with no real yoga experience. That's a problem. But you also have the other side. There's a problem as well, which is as you build your capital, you have to be willing to use the capital as leverage. And that can sometimes be uncomfortable, right? When you're using your capital as leverage, that's where you start to shape your career towards things that resonate, away from things that don't, towards behaviors that resonate, away from behaviors that don't. And that often can be at odds with, for example, what the promotion ladder is in your organization. That can be odds at cultural expectations. So when it comes to courage in building a career you love, where I think the courage really shows up is in the step of once you recognize that you have skills and you're valuable, that you have the courage to say, I'm going to invest this capital. I'm not just going to let it accrue and have my career just be shaped by other people and other forces until I'm 65 and retiring and realize I've been pretty, you know, burnt out. So you have this sort of difficulty of pure capital. You got to build it, but then you got to be willing to use it. And that can be more difficult than people sometimes expect.
I think that's such a great distinction. You know, one other thought on this using career capital. I just love this framework because, again, it seems to simplify what the veteran's job is, which is to build up skill sets, to build up that career capital. And I just wanted to read an excerpt I really liked. You shared this story about Mike Jackson. And I love the way you explained it. You said Mike Jackson leveraged the craftsman mindset to do whatever he did really well, thus ensuring that he came away from each experience with as much career capital as possible. He never had elaborate plans for his career. Instead, after each work and experience, he would stick his head up to see who was interested in his newly expanded store of capital and then jump at whatever opportunity seemed most promising. And, you know, I think again of Steve Reinemann, who was the CEO of PepsiCo. And when I went into that interview, I thought he always had this ambition to be CEO of a Fortune 100 company. And it was completely the opposite. It was exactly like Mike Jackson. Every role this guy had, he put his head down and he just focused on doing his very best at building up the best team and best skill set possible. And then one day when he did stick his head up like Mike Jackson did and looked around, he realized that an opportunity awaiting him was the CEO position of PepsiCo. But I feel like so often for myself and people I speak with, it seems like we have this end game in mind rather than just really blowing out what we have. And like Cal just said, then having the courage to use that capital, even if it is uncomfortable, even if it is go against, you know, what's expected of you, to cash in that capital to go on to whatever excites you.
And that's probably the first thing I noticed in doing the research for this book that surprised me was how often people who love what they do had no idea in advance that that's what they're going to be doing. It was something like 9 out of 10 of the people I interviewed who are very passionate about their work had no idea in advance that that's what they were going to do, that their paths were like the CEO of PepsiCo or like Mike Jackson or like Steve Jobs, with whom I opened the book. Their paths were messy and serendipitous and unexpected, and they did things well. They built capital that led to other opportunities, and they look back 15 years later and they say, oh my God, I'm in a situation I love. This is great. This is a great job. I'm very passionate. And they had no idea in advance, which again, just that data point alone should be a huge red flag for people who are hanging their entire career strategy on this idea that I'm going to figure out my passion in advance, and then that's going to tell me exactly what to do for the rest of my career.
I love that. And let me actually jump ahead with that, because one of the things I wanted to talk about was you have a great section around finding a mission. And I don't want to go into the full section, because I think you develop it really well, but you elaborate on this concept of, and I'll read this quote, but you say, if you want to identify a mission for your working life, you must first get to the cutting edge, the only place where these missions become visible. And I love that you build up this sense that, like you just said, like no one really knows that passion or that mission at the outset. But it's people who take, you talk about these bite-sized bets where people take little bets. They get a little bit of information. They take little bets and little information. They keep on taking these little bets and working diligently. And eventually they're at the cutting edge where they see that possibility for a mission that might really excite them. But that comes so far down the road versus, you know, trying to determine that at the outset, which would be impossible to do.
Yeah, because it's something I noticed that if you take a pool of people who love what they do, there's always going to be a sizable subset that part of why they love what they do is they have this real clear mission for their working life. You know, I am trying to cure cancer with technique X. This business I'm running is trying to bring this new whatever technology to the market that no one's ever seen before. My nonprofit's trying to do Y. They have some mission. Now, not everyone who loves what they do has a mission, but it's common. So I wanted to understand, how do people develop these missions that their whole career can be built around, which is such a source of satisfaction. And I think you summarized it just right, is that my research made it clear is they don't figure out the mission in advance and then go and try to act on it. Almost always, missions that matter, professional missions that the world cares about, require you to first be an expert in that field. That until you build an expertise in a field, you're almost it's almost impossible for you to develop a compelling mission in that field that really matters to the world. So again, it comes back to this notion: stop trying to figure out in advance. You know, if you try to sit there right out of college or right out of the service and say, "What's the mission I'm going to orient my career around?" You're probably going to come up with something that's naive or it's not going to work. Instead, put the head down, get to the cutting edge, get good. It requires expertise to find the missions that actually matter in almost any field.
I love that too. And I think I imagine why that resonates so much is that the veteran community at large is so mission driven, and they have come from 5 or 10 or 20 years of having a very strong purpose, a very strong mission, a very strong identity with that. And so I think it's natural that when someone leaves the military, they want just as compelling of a mission. And if I'm interpreting this correctly, it seems like, hey, you know, your mission is not to find your next mission. Your mission is to just start building up capital. Your mission is to plop down at whatever seems right in that moment and start developing skills, start really refining skills to be more valuable, to get to that cutting edge, to get to that expertise. And that's going to maximize your chances of finding, you know, what that next mission might be.
Yeah, I mean, the rule is pretty simple. If you get world-class at something, you can identify world-class missions related to that topic. If you're an amateur at something, the missions you're going to identify are going to be amateur missions, and nothing good's going to come of them. So, yeah, master something, and suddenly you're going to notice really compelling opportunities. Start from scratch, and it's like you're at the kiddie table. You're not really going to come up with something that the world cares about.
I love it. I love it. And kind of going along with that, I love this distinction you had in the book between deliberate practice versus hard work. And I found this was very convicting for me because I think I'm great at like enduring. I'm great at like just putting my head down and getting through anything and that hard work piece. And I like that you kind of, you know, I felt called out about that, where it's not necessarily hard work, but deliberate practice. And I like, one of the things I liked about this is that you talk about how deliberate practice is often the opposite of enjoyable. How, and you give some great examples of I think music and a couple other things where you're forcing yourself to practice the thing that you're least comfortable with. And I think of like the way that I would practice piano, where I just fly through the pieces I knew the best and I would ignore the ones I didn't know. But if I had been doing deliberate practice, I would have been living in the pieces where I was the worst and those sections that I struggled the most. And it is uncomfortable. It's really uncomfortable being in that space where you're not doing well. But I like that, and I wonder what else you'd want to share with people about deliberate practice as they go to develop this career capital.
Yeah, because if you want to get better at a complex skill, we now have 3 decades of research that says you have to do these deliberate practice activities. You have to take the thing you're trying to get better at, stretch yourself beyond where you're comfortable, and use harsh feedback to sort of keep your energies focused where they're most relevant. So just like, you know, if you want to get a muscle bigger, you got to lift things that are heavier than you're comfortable handling. So you get that strain, you get that stretch and muscle failure so that the muscle can grow bigger. It's the same thing with improving any sort of cognitive skill. It's not comfortable. It's hard. You're stretching yourself. But on the other hand, it's very different than being busy or just grinding for the sake of grinding. If you study, for example, a professional musician, you'll notice they're not super busy and they're not grinding 15 hours a day. If you study professional musicians, they'll do 2 hours of incredibly intense, deliberate practice on improving the part of the piece they're not good at. They'll take a break, they'll do another 2 hours, and that's their day. Those 2 hours were incredibly deliberate, and they were pushing themselves on the things they need to get better at. But that was all that mattered for them getting better. They don't then spend all day doing emails and running around and jumping on calls and doing all these other things we often do in the knowledge work sector to try to convince ourselves that we're worthy and working hard. Busyness is essentially irrelevant to the development of world-class skills. And so it's not something to embrace. Like, I want to be real busy. That's a badge of honor. It's something to be wary about. You want to make sure that you're not too busy, because that's something that's getting in the way of the actual cognitive strength training that matters.
I mean, it strikes me, and I love the metaphor you use with exercise. And it's like, you know, for people who exercise routinely, they know that like if you work out your arms today, you're not working them out tomorrow. Like, you have to have that time to recover. And it seems like that busyness is the antithesis of that. It's like not giving you that recovery time that's necessary, or it's coming at the expense of that really deliberate practice time.
Yeah. When you think about someone being really busy in the knowledge work world, the right image to come to your brain is to think about, you know, the guy at the gym in the sweatsuit who's sort of just walking at a moderate pace on the treadmill while talking on the phone, and then gets on some, you know, weight machine and is just with a light amount of weight, just 1, 2, 3, going through his 20 reps that he has written down on the piece of paper, right? That's the guy that's not going to get stronger, who's not going to get more fit. You know, it's the guy deadlifting or squatting the weight that's a little bit heavier than they're comfortable with that's actually getting stronger. So think about the guy on the treadmill barely walking, you know, with the phone, when you think about someone who's like, man, I'm crazy busy with all these emails and meetings. It shouldn't conjure impressiveness. It should conjure empathy. Like, oh, that's too bad. I'm sorry that you're having to go through that, because that's keeping you away from the stuff that's really valuable.
I love that. I love that. And I just think of all the times on our submarine where busyness was prized, and even at business school and afterwards, it just seemed like that was if you weren't busy, there was something wrong with you. And it was like an admission of some sort of failure. And I love changing that mental construct of that. I love that image of the guy on the treadmill on the phone. You know, that's like that, my new image for someone who's busy.
Yeah. I mean, it's basically impressive people can often be surprisingly lazy seeming when you meet them, because the whole thing that made them impressive is that they really don't care about much except for the core thing they're trying to get better at and do at a world-class level. Mm.
And I wanted to talk that the last area was around control. And I love that you talk about the control that's acquired. Oh, actually, wait, one step back on deliberate practice. I also love it at the end of the book, with that deliberate practice piece, you talked about how you would attack a new project or a new skill. And you said, I'm going to work for an hour, even if I faint, even if I pass out, I am going to sit here and I'm going to do this for an hour. And I love that you pointed out that it seems like after about 10 minutes, that feeling of wanting to give up or that feeling of wanting to leave goes away. And so it was just building up that muscle to power past the desire to quit or to move on to something easier or to move on to something that's busy work. And that discomfort doesn't even last the whole time. It's just kind of a periodic thing that if we can push back the initial piece of it, you know, that might go away. And so I love that mindset of like, hey, even if I pass out in an hour, I'm going to sit here. I'm going to write this essay. I'm going to study this marketing topic. I'm going to do whatever this skill set takes.
Right. Give the phone to your wife and say, under no circumstances, give this back to me until an hour's past. Because that's like 80% of the secret is that the way our brains are wired is that it's going to give resistance to doing hard cognitive work at first. And so basically, if you just get comfortable with the idea that that resistance will go away after about 10 minutes, you have this massive competitive advantage over most people out there, because for most people, that resistance that the brain is always going to put up leads them to the run for the hills, which in the digital world means, you know, Facebook or something. But you know what I mean? It leads them. They're like, I don't want to do this. I need to check this and do email and talk to someone. So if you know that that strain is temporary and you can get through it, you've convinced yourself of that, it's sort of your own sort of cognitive hell week in buds or something, like, hey, if I've gone through that, I know it's going to be okay on the other end. You have this huge competitive advantage, because most people in cognitive sectors run for the hills when they feel the discomfort that comes along with trying to strain your mind. So power through, it gets better, and then suddenly, you know, you're doing the exercise no one else knows about. You're going to get a big win for it.
Hmm. I love that, and I appreciate that. I do think that it's something veterans should recognize too, is that, you know, when it comes to career capital, that ability to push oneself beyond limits, that's such a valuable skill. And when I think of, you know, I gave that example of Jimmy Sopko starting at the ground floor of Pinterest. I think one of the things that helped him advance, you know, he's a much more senior position now, one of the things that helped him advance was that work ethic, was that integrity, was that discipline and ability to just really work smartly and use that deliberate practice approach. And so the last thing around control, I love that you talk about how control that's acquired without career capital is not sustainable. And you give a couple compelling examples where someone makes a decision to get more control in their career, but it's very short term. It's the person who starts the yoga studio. It's the person who quits their job to start a blog about quitting their job. And they have that momentary like sugar rush of control, but it's not sustainable because they don't have the career capital to back it up. And I love that you talk about doing what people are willing to pay for and using this dollar benchmark to say whether it's worth jumping off or not. And I wonder if you could expand on that, this thought of like using whether someone will pay you for something as kind of a litmus test of whether it's worth branching off for that.
Right, because you need some way of measuring, do I have enough career capital that if I make a drastic change to try to get more control, so I quit my job to start a new business or something like this, do I have enough career capital that I can actually succeed with that and earn that control? And one way to assess it, and this is an idea that was given to me by the entrepreneur and writer Derek Sivers, is he said, money is a neutral indicator of value. In other words, people will tell you all day long, oh, you're great, you should do that, that sounds great, you should go for it, how brave. The give people verbal encouragement is for free, but people hate to give up their money. People do not like to give away money they have to someone else, and people essentially won't do it unless they really think they're getting value in return. So Derek's simple idea was find a way to put your career capital out there to the market. So maybe don't quit completely and start a new company. Offer some of those services on the side. See how many units or products you can sell. Wait till you see there's a lot of money coming in before you actually make the bigger jump. And it's not for him about money's what matters. For him, it's about money doesn't really lie. So if people are giving you a lot of money for this product, that means the product is actually valuable. If people are actually trying to hire you to consult, they'll give you their money to do it, then you must have enough skills that the marketplace values it. So I love that idea of how do you assess how valuable a particular skill or product is let money be this great, neutral, fair judge and give you very precise feedback about the where you are.
And I think that's great too. I know, you know, being in a startup and having interviewed a lot of people in startups, it is about developing a product that someone's willing to pay for, you know, and that's where this concept of selling vaporware comes in, where so many companies will start to sell a product that doesn't even exist. And then they'll build it, you know, once they've qualified that people are willing to pay for it. And so I think that that concept is really well developed in the startup world. But I think that's it's a great fallback option for any veteran to think of. It's a great litmus test of as you think of doing something new, is there the money there? Is someone willing to pay you to do consulting? Is someone willing to pay you to do something? Because there are a lot of people who care about you and will say favorable things to support you, but that might not be supporting you if in actuality there's not going to be the long-term support of someone giving you money to do it.
Yeah, I mean, money is a very useful gauge for understanding how valuable certain things in your life actually are.
Well, Cal, this is awesome. I really appreciate your writing the book, and then I really appreciate your taking the time to break this into terms for veterans. And, you know, for those listening, it's 230 pages long. This book should exactly be 230 pages. I know a lot of books, you get it gets pumped up with air, they inflate it to make it bigger, but it's very efficient. Cal does a great job of just building on the material. And so he summarizes the end of the chapter, brings it up at the start of the next in a way that really puts this deep in your brain, makes it easy for recovery. And I just think that this subject, I found it very relevant to my life. And I just thinking of, you know, the 80 interviews I've done so far with other veterans, this is advice I think that would benefit every single veteran I've interviewed and every single person that's reached out to me as one of the listeners. So Cal, thank you for your time today on this.
Listen, thanks for the kind words about the book and for the opportunity to share some of these ideas with your audience. I really enjoyed it.
Surface.
Thank you for listening to this episode with Cal Newport and Beyond the Uniform. Special thanks to our editor, Kathleen Dillon, for doing show notes and text transcripts of all of our interviews. Steve Bain, Director of Outreach, leading our sponsorship effort, as well as outreach to the guests on the show. Andrew Woolridge, who heads up data analytics and insights to help us figure out how to grow our audience. If you are enjoying the show, the best thing you can do to help us is tell a friend, tell 1,000 friends, or even post a positive review on iTunes. All of these things get this in front of more veterans and help us have a bigger impact. Have a great week, and I'll be back next week with more interviews with military veterans about their civilian career. Take care.